afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. The time is 1:32, March 16, 2015. With me today is Senator Geisel, Senator Ellis, and myself, Stedman. We do have a quorum. We've got some business to conduct today. On the agenda is to review appointments for the governor. The committee has circulated a list of names before the committee to see if members had any questions. So far, there's been no questions or concerns that have come back. We're going to hold off on the commissioner until we deal with the majority of the list. So what I'll do, I think for formality, I'll go ahead and read off the folks. I'll try not to mispronounce names, but no guarantees. We're being joined by Senator Stoltz. And then if any of the committee members have questions, concerns, or anything with any of the names, just signal the chair. We'll go ahead and pull them off for a separate discussion. That way we can kind of clear the vast majority of the names. And then when we're done with that, we'll come back and we'll have a conversation with the commissioner appointee. If that's acceptable, a list of the names, other than on the agenda today, the commissioner. For the Board of Dental Examiners, Dr. Thomas Kavalowski from Chugiak, Dr. David Nielsen from Anchorage, Pamela Ross from Anchorage, Dr. Paul Silvera from Valdez. Seeing no concerns on those, we'll jump to the Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees, Christopher Cook from Anchorage, Mary Michael from Anchorage, Board of Nursing, Julie Gillette from Fairbanks, and Cheryl Toscano from Anchorage. For the Board of Examiners for Optometry, Paul Barney from Anchorage. The Board of Pharmacy, Leif Holm from North Pole. We'll jump to the Board of Therapists, David Edward Smith from Soldotna, Amanda Unser from Anchorage, Tracy Gilmore from Juneau, Ron Gibbs from Kodiak, Shirley Nelson from Anchorage, the State Medical Board, Dr. Stephen Humphreys from Soldotna, from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees, Colton Smith of Juneau. For the Board of Examiners in Optometry, Dr. Stephen Starkla from Anchorage, and for Violent Crimes Compensation Board, Dr. George Brown from Douglas. They seem no concerns. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any concerns, but I had the privilege of these mental health trustee appointees came through finance, and we always use it as an educational opportunity, but we don't have time for that today. But I do want to say this is one of the most important boards, and their role of responsibility toward the beneficiaries includes everything from Alaskans with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and I know both of these board members. This is a board where politics doesn't matter. There's anybody that serves on this board has a strong history of supporting the beneficiaries, and I hope they also will also recognize not only responsibilities for the opportunities for developing the land and mineral resources of which the Mental Health Trust has a stewardship and trust responsibility for the beneficiaries, and that a viewshed doesn't become more important in their deliberations than providing mental health services, services for Alaskans with autism, Down syndrome, and the whole panoply of mental health beneficiary issues, and that'd be the one thing I'd want on the record that the importance of them, especially as we get into a time of increased budget pressure, that they remember their trust responsibility to the beneficiaries, which includes developing resources to benefit those trustees, that the trust responsibility is an incredible legal and moral responsibility, and I hope they will always remember that as they're making the decisions. And from speaking only for myself, when they want to make a controversial decision, if it's going to benefit the beneficiaries, I've got their back, so do a lot of their colleagues. And that's the only comments I'll have on the appointees other than the commissioners. Senator, thank you.
Seeing no other comments, and Senator Stoltz all warmed up. Senator Stoltz, could we have a motion to move these pre-listed folks forward?
Thank you. With that, thank you for my valedictory moment. With that, I will move that the committee forward the nominations with the prescripted language, as previously noted, to send to the floor for confirmation hearings.
Do we have any objection? And just for the record, seeing no objections, we'll move these forward. And just for the record, this does not mean support or non-support of any of these members, but we're just moving the names forward to the floor. With that, I'd like to go ahead and have Commissioner nominee Davidson come forward, please. She has been nominated as Commissioner of Health and Social Services, one of the largest departments within the state, a very significant position with well over $1 billion in climbing budget. And I would like to have her tell the committee a little bit about herself and why we should object to her name going forward and why we should offer her support possibly. After she identifies herself, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Davidson, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Health and Social Services. A little bit about myself. I was born in the old hospital, old Indian Health Service Hospital in Bethel, where my mother worked in medical records. I was born and raised in Bethel and also upriver in Adiac, about 150 river miles. And I lived there until I was about 12. I'm a Head Start kid. At the time, our Head Start program was called Children's Cash, which is an unfortunate name because I think literally it means a place to store children. That's not what they did, though. We had a very robust program. Bless you. We had a very robust program. I received almost all of my health care services from Clara Morgan, who was our community health practitioner, who retired after over 40 years of service. And Clara and our Head Start teacher were actually cousins, and they were also the mothers of our friends. And so between the two of them, there literally was nothing we could get away with in the community, which was actually looking at the time, I think at the moment for some kids they thought it was a little bit unfortunate, but looking back, it was definitely the way to go. Definitely subscribe to It Takes a Village to be able to produce healthy, productive kids, and they certainly took that as their mantra. Whenever Clara Morgan walked into a basketball game or walked into the store, if we were perhaps on the verge of making unhealthy choices, one stern look from her made us reevaluate things quite quickly. When I was 12, my dad's job changed, and we moved to Salcha outside of Fairbanks. He was a civilian employee at Eielson Air Force Base, and so I went to the last 3 weeks of elementary school at Salcha Elementary School, joined the Salcha Ski Club there, and went to junior high and high school at Eielson Air Force Base. And it was quite a cultural change. I think there were four Native students in the school, my brothers, my sister, and me. The good news is my mother is that there is no excuses, no nonsense kind of Yupik philosophy, and she expected us to rise to the occasion and make friends, and it quite frankly expected us to thrive. I started school for undergrad at UAF in Fairbanks, and then I transferred to come to school here in Juneau. I actually worked, I did an internship for then Senator John Binkley, back when he still spelled his first name with an E on the end, in Senate Finance. And then after that internship was over, I got hired on as staff, and I worked for him during the day, and then I went to school full-time at night. Finished an undergrad degree in elementary education with a specialty in early childhood and a minor in bilingual education. I'm a strong believer in early childhood experiences, teaching children healthy habits when they're really young, to be able to set them up to make healthy decisions throughout their lifetime. After that, I went to graduate school at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, the only time I have ever lived out of state. Came back to Alaska, worked in Anchorage for about a year, and every time I would see a jet fly over, I would think, I wonder if that jet is going to Bethel. And after I did that for a year, I actually moved back home to Bethel, where I began my career in tribal health. I worked for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation for 7 years, 3 of those years as general counsel, 4 of those years as executive vice president, and then moved to the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, statewide tribal health organization in Anchorage, where I worked for 8 years. And that's probably all I should say about me. In terms of, did you want to know about priorities for the department, or?
Well, where do you want to be commissioner? And then we can get into the department stuff. But what, sure, what motivated you to take on this difficult job in a time when we have a little bit shortage of cash?
Well, I will tell you first off that I have heard some friends who are, quite frankly, I've known for 30 years, who've called me and said, what were you thinking, Val? We thought you had such good judgment. And you're right, it is a big job. It is definitely a big department, a big complicated budget. But the truth is that somebody has to do these jobs, and I've never shied away from taking on a tough job. My family history, lots of interest in healthcare when I was small. I was pretty severely burned when I was 4 on my back, and unfortunately by my 2 best friends who were boys. Luckily, one of their fathers was a pilot, and so they flew me into Anchorage. I was in the hospital at the old Alaska Native Medical Center for about 3.5 or 4 months. There were only 15 patient housing rooms at the time. And my mother could only stay with me for 2 weeks, and the rest of the time I was there entirely by myself. And I think that I have always been interested in improving healthcare systems, just from my personal experience as a child, and knowing some of the challenges that people in our state face. Some of my particular passions are child welfare cases, just from my past personal history and family history. I know that I'm very fortunate. I have never been a foster child. Right now, we have over 2,500 kids in out-of-home placements. Our new numbers just came out. We had been saying over 2,400 kids, which was in itself a record. And what I know, just from over the years, is that what we're doing right now isn't working. Our numbers are getting worse. They're not getting better. And one of the priorities of mine at the department is to be able to develop better partnerships with tribes and the federal government to be able to solve these problems together. Because I think, quite frankly, the state has shown that the state can't do it alone. I think tribes have shown that they can't do it alone, and the federal government certainly can't do it alone. And we've also seen that even 2 out of 3 isn't enough. That really, even in the best of times, we all have to come together, talk about what each of us are doing, what resources we're putting into solving some of our challenges, both in terms of human resources as well as financial resources, to be able to do a better job of coordinating care. And I think that was true before we were having our budget challenge. But now that we are in our budget situation, I think it's that much more critical. My style has always been pretty straightforward. I think that I'm pretty collaborative. I think that it's sort of funny when you take these jobs, you get a lot of advice from people. And one piece of advice I heard from somebody is, well, you want to talk to these kind of people, but don't talk to those kind of people. And I said, you know, that's just not really my style. I think that unless you have a diversity of opinion and can have a conversation about real issues, then you're not going to really get to the solutions that we need to see as a state. And the truth is, if I was only going to talk to people, quite frankly, who think like me or who sound like me, I could probably save ourselves a lot of time and just lock myself in the bathroom and have a conversation with the mirror. But the truth is, that isn't really going to get us to where we need to be. In terms of priorities for the department, I really see four besides the ones that we've been working on already. The first is to try and create a sustainable healthcare delivery system. I believe, and I've made no secret about this, that I believe that expansion and reform go hand in hand. As Governor Walker indicated in his State of the Budget, he asked his commissioners to look at what would your department look like at 25% less budget in 4 years. And our department, $2.7 billion, about $1.7 billion of that is Medicaid. $700 million of that is state GF of that Medicaid budget. And so we really see that reform is really our opportunity to be able to meet those budget challenges. Second priority I see for the department are child welfare matters, as I mentioned before. We are actually going to be doing a pretty historic meeting in April to be able to bring tribal and federal partners together along with state partners, with the state, to be able to have a conversation about what I talked about before, who's doing what, and in what arenas, what are the things that we're doing that may be standing in the way of each other's progress, so that we can move forward. That meeting will be happening probably later in April, but we're having a planning meeting next week to really talk about what's the best way to be able to set that up to do that. The third priority I mentioned before, working with our state and federal partners, and somebody said to me, well, that's not really a priority, that's really a strategy. And my response was, yes, technically you're right, but quite frankly, we have, unless we actually elevate those partnerships to a priority, my worry is that we won't take advantage of the opportunities to be able to focus on that. And then the fourth priority are just really improving a lot of the health and wellness opportunities that we have, that quite frankly are wellness and prevention opportunities that we have in the state. We have the opportunity to make some pretty significant investments to be able to save costs further down the road.
Have any initial questions from committee members? Could you, Senator Stoltz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Davidson, toward the end of the meeting, when you were last time here, we talked about the issue of stakeholders and people with those disparate views. And we had probably the best attended. And going back to my memory, it's a little bit sketchy at times, but you said you embrace all points of view and work together. And there are some groups that are representing a lot, American taxpayers and disparate points of view on the Medicaid expansion. And I took that as a good sign of faith because everybody being at the table, as we clarified that, more than just having them in for a three-minute testimony, but actually having a meaningful dialogue. A couple weeks and maybe a week or so ago, we had probably the best attended lunch and learn, and actually people came and stayed and learned, unlike a lot of the other events, and it was probably the most interactive and vibrant. But I noticed both during the meeting and then after in press comments there was a combativeness, and it didn't sound like a shared stakeholder, like a welcome stakeholder. Have you thought about, and I know there's differing points of view and you probably felt a need to contest some things you disagreed with, but then in a lot of the other comments we heard from administration folks and then some of the normal operatives, it almost like there was a beachhead warfare. Let's hold the Huns back here. Have you rethought some of that interchange and some of the following things and how even people that have a different point of view, whether it's the policy forum folks or the folks that were here with the lunch and learn presentation, and would you do everything the same again?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I think that, I mean, I do welcome a diversity of opinion. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm necessarily going to agree, that they certainly aren't necessarily going to agree with me either. But when I do, have a difference of opinion, or I believe that something For example, in that lunch and learn, there was a slide that indicated Medicaid expansion from a couple of different states, but the years that were used were between the years 1999 and 2011. And Medicaid expansion that we're talking about under the Affordable Care Act actually wasn't authorized until January 1st of 2014. So I did ask the question, what about the calendar year 2014? Because then we would be comparing, I felt we would be comparing blueberries to blueberries and not necessarily what a state had done prior to that time. And I guess, you know, looking back and also looking forward, because I think I know there are a number of different opportunities for there are some folks who think that we should do reform first and then expansion. We believe that reform and expansion can go hand in hand. I think those are different perspectives, and I think I don't think that we're necessarily going to 100% agree all the time. And I guess as I look forward, I hope that we can continue to have those honest conversations with each other where we do disagree, because I think that what we have seen in our state is that when we do have the opportunity to have those conversations out in the open, then we do have a diversity of opinion. And in fact, there is going to be another lunch and learn on Thursday here in the building. I think Ashna is going to be presenting as well as Evergreen Economics. And but again, it's, you know, being able to have a conversation from different perspectives, I think quite frankly both need to happen.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you. So, Ms. Davidson, could you give us some examples of when in your history of working in the healthcare industry you've worked outside the federal or native healthcare system? That is to say, you've actually worked with private sector providers.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, probably the best opportunity would be I was also in my role in tribal health. When I worked for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation under Commissioner Gilbertson, when he was commissioner, the state had a financial challenge and was looking at ways to be able to enhance the tribal health system's ability to be able to provide care, quite frankly, as a way to be able to maximize 100% federal match savings. And at the time, there were five different nonprofit organizations that were non-tribal in the Bethel area that had provided services, everything from developmental disability services, infant learning services, children's group home services, a variety of other services. And at the time, we were asked by the commissioner, by the state, to come together to talk about ways to be able to develop partnerships, to be able to transition those services. And it was no small undertaking. We had a lot of community meetings in which those meetings were pretty tough. And I have to say that from the, for example, Bethel Community Services had a program that they started from scratch at a time when the Indian Health Service was providing care in the region before it was YKHC. And the Indian Health Service didn't provide DD services. It didn't provide infant learning programs at all. They didn't do any of that. And so some community members came together and said, our community, our region needs services. And so it was kind of like they started these programs, very grassroots programs. There was a huge wait list to be able to get people served. And the way that the wait list happened was it was a statewide wait list. We were able to negotiate an arrangement with the state where there was a little bit of a the rate. So, for example, even if you were number three on the wait list, statewide wait list, but you were the next person in the Bethel area to get services. You still, and Bethel had the capacity to provide services. You still had to wait until the other two people had placement before you even had the opportunity to get service, even if you were, that capacity was available locally. We were able to, working with Bethel Community Services, working with YKHC, and working with the state, able to get people off the wait list faster to be able to get them served. And it was a very challenging time. In the community, I kind of likened it to, they started these programs from scratch. It was almost like watching a baby grow. And the baby had reached a level of maturity where it was ready to move on. And just like any other parent, I mean, I felt this way when my 22-year-old, who's going to nursing school, went to UAA, and that was just down the road, that when your child matures and they go off into the world, you have all of those worries of, is this person going to take care of my program? Is this person going to do the right thing for people? Are people going to still get the care that they need? And at the time, it was politically and emotionally really tough for everybody involved. And ultimately, through a series of community meetings, people came together and said, at the BCS side, you know, we don't really want to do this. But we also recognize that it isn't about us. It's about doing what's right for children and doing what's right for families. And they agreed to be able to do this transition. And we had meetings literally every day. We had meetings with the organization. We had meetings with the state. And it was a really challenging process to make sure that not only could services be provided, but they could also be expanded in ways that, quite frankly, I think nobody actually among all of those groups really envisioned were possible to be able to work together. Because in the beginning, a response was, no, we're not doing this, we're not interested. And ultimately, it became a conversation about what's right for the people of the region and what makes sense that will allow services to be provided while saving state general fund dollars. But it was not easy, and we actually transitioned 5 programs in 10 months. We thought we were going to do an analysis after 2 months and then do a recommendation and then be able to implement, but that wasn't possible in the time frame. It was a much more expedited time frame.
Do we have a follow-up question?
Well, I do.
I'm not quite sure I heard an answer to that question. It went on and on and on. But
I'm sorry.
And so kind of tagging on to some of the things you said, you know, again, you're talking about working with corporate-type groups. Commissioner Gilbertson believed that healthcare was going to transition from the small independent clinic individual physician or small physician group to a large hospital. Everyone is going to be based in a hospital. How do you plan to go forward working with the diverse types of healthcare providers we have in the state? They're not all large corporations. They're not all large institutional healthcare providers. They're independent practitioners in various type scenarios.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, thank you for clarifying. I apologize. I think I got the question completely wrong. So to answer your first question, no, I haven't worked for a non-tribal health provider in the past. But in terms of moving forward, one of the things that I'm most excited about is we actually have an RFP on the street right now. I think their request, the bidders are due this week to be able to look at healthcare reform in our state, being able to reform our Medicaid program. And we are actually, so we have whoever the successful bidder is, and I quite frankly have no idea who's expressed interest, but what they are required to do is look at what reform opportunities have been done in other states, not only for expansion, but for regular Medicaid, because quite frankly it's much bigger than expansion. And also look at waiver programs in other states, bring all those reform opportunities, do an analysis of what they think would work for us in Alaska, given our small population size, but our large geography where we know travel is an issue. And then also the other part of it, which I think is equally important, is to be able to engage stakeholders and get their ideas for what they would like to do, what do they see our best reform opportunities to be able to move forward. Because quite frankly, I think we have to get there. I mean, I think unless we all come together to be able to have that conversation, we are not going to be able to redesign our Medicaid system in a way that makes sense for the long term and is sustainable. And I recognize that, you know, even in tribal health, there are some large providers. There are some pretty big ones. But there are also some co-signers to the health compact that are one tribe. And one of the things that I appreciated in the tribal health system is when they were negotiating the Alaska Tribal Health Compact is that everybody has a seat at the table and everybody has a voice in the process. And those are really tough conversations, but they are necessary conversations. I think it has served the tribal health system well to be able to have those conversations about similarities and conversations about differences, because what works for a small one isn't necessarily going to work for a large one and vice versa. But being able to ensure that everybody has a seat at the table will allow us to be able to get there.
Thank you. Further questions for the commissioner appointee? Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is very specific to my district, but it's my opportunity, and I appreciate your presentation and want to go down here to the micro level. Two of my constituents, Faith Myers and Dorrance Collins, they may be well known to folks. They are longtime advocates over the years to change and improve the psychiatric patients' grievance procedures. And they met with resistance from the previous administration. There was no time or attention. I'd just like to ask you to take note, and you have bigger fish to fry here in the next, before the 90 days are over, but at some point there will be an opportunity to interact with these folks, and I'd like to ask that your department meet with the advocates to determine how the department can work with both the advocates and consumers of mental health services to come up with solutions and to address their concerns. And you may want to have, someone in behavioral health put together a smaller working group or through the Mental Health Trust Authority. I don't want it to be a big time consuming project, though there will need to be an attention to detail on a psychiatric patient's grievance procedure that needs to be upgraded. And there are models among other states, and we haven't been doing a good job in this state. To date, we could be open to expensive litigation, and I think there's a way to collaborate and fend off any kind of negative efforts in the future. So, I noticed you were writing that down, and through the chair, Mr. Chairman, to the commissioner, I appreciate you taking note.
Okay,
that's it.
Okay, thank you. We have other questions? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the Medicaid payment system is not working very well. What is the status of the MMS system, the Xerox system, and what do you foresee as the time frame for actually getting healthcare providers paid for their services?
And if I could add just a little more to our question, when do you feel that you may have, you know, the bugs fumigated in the computer system?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, and Mr. Chair, I think I got that right. So for Xerox, the payment system, the MMIS payment system, we recognize that there have been challenges. And I don't say that lightly. I know that there have been some significant challenges. Xerox was awarded the contract in 2007. The original go-live date was actually in 2010. but the actual go-live date was in October 2013. I think one of the biggest challenges was that the system that was supposed to be tested before it went live wasn't rigorously tested, and we know that we need to improve the accuracy of the claims as well as timeliness. And so we know that there are providers who aren't getting paid on time. And we have made some improvements. In terms of, here's a little bit more of our history. The Division of Healthcare Services have really, Director Brody and her team have really been working hard offline, off the MMIS system, to make sure that providers could get paid. And there is a lot of, quite frankly, a lot of double work that has been happening over the last several years just to get providers paid. We know that things have improved, but they haven't improved enough for us to be able to get the backloads taken care of. We believe that going forward, those claims are paying more timely. According to Director Brody, 97% of the claims are paying accurately, are paid timely and correctly. But I should clarify for the record, just to be sure that you know, those are new claims. Those aren't claims that are in pended status. And quite frankly, as a state, we have done our best in the new administration to be as transparent as possible where those backlogs are. We've started posting them actually to our website so that the public can see and providers can see. We had the department actually sued Xerox, the vendor, and there was a hearing in February for some claims. And those were not contract claims. Those were liquidated damages. And the question there before the administrative law judge, not in Superior Court, were because they were before an administrative law judge because it was a contract requirement. They are under conditions of performance that were supposed to have been all cleared at the end of February. They are still working through those. They are making progress on current claims, but we do have a backlog of past claims and pended claims. Quite frankly, my conversations with the vendor have been frank. They have indicated that they have virtually solved all of the problems, to which my response has been, if you have virtually solved all of the problems, there would have been a parade of providers beating down my door, thanking me for the incredible progress that has been made. So I'm not sure what your definition of incredible progress is versus what we are seeing in terms of the amount of work that it takes for the Division of Healthcare Services to be able to get providers paid. But one thing we do know, though, now, which we see as a good sign, is that providers are actually contacting the Division of Healthcare Services to set up repayment for the advances that they received. Quite frankly, over the last couple of years, again, before my time, there were some providers who had to have advance payments just so that they could keep their doors open and continue to provide services. At the time, unfortunately, those advance payments had to be made just to be able to get providers, be able to have them continue to provide care. And I definitely see it as a good sign that providers are contacting us, asking about repayment options and interested in being in repaying. So in terms of current, I guess that was, my answers today are really long. I apologize. Apparently I ramble when I am very nervous. My apologies. So let me cut to the chase. For the new claims that are going into the system, Director Brody tells me that 97% are paying, and they're paying correctly. We still have a backlog for the pended claims and for the claims that are in what are called suspense or denied. So we are making progress, but it, quite frankly, it's not as fast as any of us would like it to be.
Yes, thank you. So approximately how many are in this backlog, and what do you see as the time frame for getting all of that paid off?
You can ask for a lifeline if you need to.
Yes, may I ask for a lifeline? I'm sorry, I wasn't sure if that was allowed in a confirmation hearing, but if I may ask my deputy commissioner for Medicaid and
we don't
all things that are really smart.
All the answers
smart.
When you first get it appointed. We'll give you a year.
Thank you. For the record, I'm John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Currently, all of our suspended claims amount to about a little over 100,000 suspended claims, and that's about 68,000 of that is what we would refer to as math adjustments. Those are things that have come through. We've identified did not process correctly, either the rate that was paid was incorrect, or denial was made that did not appear to be appropriate logic applied. Now, in some of those cases, providers have received some payment, but there will have to be an adjustment, in some cases up, in some cases down. But that's the, in terms of the claims volume, that's the latest information I have on that.
And the projected time frame of clearing them up?
I think when we've talked about reprocessing, we don't have a fixed schedule. We see the need to be able to break it down and take it in chunks so we don't either overwhelm our staff or our providers when we feedback the information on the adjudication of the claims. And the conversations we've had to date have really looked at running it out into about August or so, maybe a little later. That's assuming that Xerox stays on track with the progress they've been making and we don't see any substantial regression.
Okay. Follow-up questions?
Well, sort of. So perhaps you could understand why with 100,000 outstanding, 68,000 that didn't process correctly, there is some reluctance on the part of some of us to see another 40,000 beneficiaries added to a system where healthcare providers aren't being paid now. How do you see this working out? I'm not sure how to ask the question.
Be a question for the appointee.
Yes, that was definitely for the commissioner, absolutely.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, as Deputy Commissioner Sherwood indicated, that we do expect to be back on track by about August. In terms of the expansion population, about 40,000 would be eligible. We actually anticipate about 20,000 would actually enroll in 2016. We have been working with Xerox to make sure that as that population comes on, that we are able to be able to get those payments claimed and paid. Providers do have, I believe, up to 1 year to meet timely filing for claiming of Medicaid claims, and quite frankly, some providers don't necessarily bill their claims immediately. So we do expect for us to be able to be ready for the expansion population, and that is something that we have directed our contractors to be ready for.
So again, that's optimistic, and bravo. It's important to be optimistic. So let's take it now from the provider side. They agree to see Medicaid folks, and they haven't been paid, but they're going to hang in there because August They're hoping they're going to get paid. But here come 20,000 more beneficiaries. Do you see the healthcare provider population being able to absorb another 20,000 folks in the Medicaid system?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, we have heard from providers that they welcome Medicaid expansion as an opportunity to provide services. Certainly, many of the individuals who are in the expansion population are getting care already. They are doing that through the emergency room. And quite frankly, many of the providers have said that they would love to be able to see them in another setting, in a primary care setting, or perhaps, as I did as a child, from a community health aide, or a community health practitioner, a behavioral health aide, or in a rural community, a dental health aide therapist. There are other providers who are absolutely ready and willing to take on Medicaid expansion, and they're excited about providing additional services. Providers aren't mandated from being a Medicaid provider. They can choose if they feel like they are at capacity. They certainly can choose not to take on any additional Medicaid patients.
Thank you. So it was interesting to me, Commissioner, that you identified community health aides, community health aide practitioners, dental therapists, dental aides. These are all part of the Native Health system, and not all Medicaid beneficiaries fall under Indian Health Service, Native Healthcare Services, right? So there are folks outside that system. You see the system being able to absorb all that?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, a couple of things. One is that for many people who live in rural communities, whether you're IHS beneficiary or not, if you're a teacher, if you're a trooper who's stationed there, perhaps you're the person who manages the store, those folks already use the tribal health system because there is no other provider available. And so in rural communities or in the larger hub communities, they don't just see IHS beneficiaries. They see anybody who needs health care, and if that person is a Medicaid beneficiary, they would bill Medicaid for that service. If it's not an IHS beneficiary, though, who receives their health care in the tribal health system, they wouldn't get the 100% federal match, or the state wouldn't receive the 100% federal match. And in fact, through an agreement that was negotiated with the Veterans Administration a couple of years ago, I think it's been 2 years ago by now, veterans who live in rural communities, whether they're Alaska Native or not, also have access to the tribal health system to be able to receive veteran services that those who are providing that care are billing the Veterans Administration for services that are provided. And but in other parts of the state, and tribal health just isn't in a rural community, it exists also in some of our larger communities as well. There are also other opportunities for nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, to be able to provide services that before in our state had only been provided by physicians. And every time we have the opportunity as a state, whether it's in tribal health through community health aides, whether it's a larger part of the state through nurse practitioners or physician's assistants, anytime we have the opportunity to look at an alternative provider type, we know that additional people can get served, and that what that also allows is for that person to operate and provide care. I have to be careful when I say operate. I don't mean like, you know, surgery. I mean provide care within the scope of their license. It also means that the physician can also practice at the full extent of their license as well.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to make comment here. Nurse practitioners have been primary care providers in this state since the early 80s, yeah. And we have had no restrictions. We practice the same as a physician. Mm-hmm. So just a slight correction there. Medicaid expansion will not change that. But getting back to, you know, you've talked a lot about access in rural areas, but 50% of Medicaid beneficiaries live in the Anchorage area. So you are expecting the Anchorage area providers or the rail belt providers to be able to absorb and desirous of absorbing additional Medicaid beneficiaries.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, we have heard from providers that they support Medicaid expansion. If you are aware of providers that don't, we would be happy to talk to them about opportunities to be able to enhance perhaps their ability to provide care.
Thank you.
See any other questions? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the previous meeting, here was a department overview, and there were several questions about expansion and the issue of, and I think reform is too limiting. Is reform, cost controls, and sustainability, I think, is more accurately describes, I think, what a lot of legislators are asking for. Your answer then was, well, pass Medicaid, and we'll work on the other thing. As your since in those intervening weeks since you've been here, has the administration rehuddled? Do they see these two issues as linked traveling companions now, out of not just political necessity but economic necessity, and to provide Alaskans more assuredness that it's not an empty promise?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, we believe that Medicaid expansion and reform go hand in hand. That we are building upon the reform efforts that the department has already undertaken, and we see there are more opportunities for reform. And I guess the short answer to your question is yes, we do see that reform and expansion can go hand in hand.
Mr. Chairman, can go hand in hand or must go hand in hand?
I think must, given our current budget scenario, I think must. As I mentioned earlier, when Governor Walker tasked his commissioners with looking at budgets of 75% of what their current budgets are for departments, and recognizing that our department is $1.7 billion of our department is Medicaid, and $700 million of that is in general fund for Medicaid, I think we have to look at reform in order, and we have to do reform in order to meet our current budget situation. I don't think we have a choice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, if I might. That's an evolution of position that I really appreciate, because it wasn't quite as certain. And I understand when you have a passion for an issue. On the issue of how can the people of Alaska, people that are concerned about aspects of government growth and rules changing, have a level of certainty about even promises made by the administration, what is actually enforceable by the federal government? We could pass statutes on doctor availability, as you said, that you can choose your own doctor. I remember another national discussion about choosing your own doctor and on the larger umbrella of this whole issue, which Alaskans and Americans know as the Affordable Care Act. So. Many of my constituents talk about drug testing, and frankly, I will take a drug test too. Be happy to, as part of public service, to provide the same certainty. But that's an issue brought up. There's a whole myriad of things, but if we can pass a law or get assurances, but how much of it can really stick with the Department of Health and Social Services and a federal administration that has their mindset on what the rules are? Do we really have the ability to pass reform, cost controls, and some of the things that our constituents demand? And will you be hand-in-hand with the legislature even on some of the controversial things? As we say, it must go together hand-in-hand, except for the parts you don't like, that's a real challenge for me, and maybe others. I only speak for myself.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, let me see if I'm going to try and answer the question that I
some of them are rhetorical statements, okay. So not all of them are probably, yeah. But I think you know the ones that were questions, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair.
So A couple of things. One is that we are in active negotiations with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services about some reform efforts already underway, regardless of expansion, quite frankly. So, for example, utilizing an 1115 waiver, for example, to be able to work with the tribal health system to be able to, quite frankly, take advantage of 100% federal match. Other opportunities are we're working with CMS at the early stages of working on 1915 I and K waivers. I realize I'm getting into numbers and alphabet soup here, I apologize, to be able to look at how we finance services that we are already providing as a state. And so those efforts are certainly underway. But I will be honest with you that this is tough stuff. I mean, Medicaid reform is tough stuff. And quite frankly, if it wasn't hard, we would have done it 15, 10, 4 years ago. But we have to keep moving forward. We don't have a choice. We are in a situation right now with our budget scenario that we can't afford to continue operating the program that we do now. But we believe that by doing expansion, leveraging federal resources, leveraging those federal opportunities, and also redesigning the way that we provide health care allows us to be able to provide health care more efficiently, making sure that we can still provide services to individuals that we know need access to health care in our state in a way that is also cost effective. But if you're asking me if I think this is easy, I don't. It's going to be challenging. It's going to be tough.
We have a bill in the committee that we'll probably have up at some point dealing with cost containment, so we can go into a lot of detail with that.
Right. Mr. Chairman, can I just ask one broad question, again, with some specific aspects? If me and a couple of my like-minded colleagues were to put together a punch list of under 10 issues, cost, care, containment, sustainability, would you be able to give us, you working with the administration, this is one of your pinnacle issues, I guess, yes, no, or we can't support us, we get an idea of where you're at, and that would help us as we get ready for the deliberative process and the others, and where we will never agree, or where you're willing to work with us, and that will give us a guideline, Mr. Chairman, is just preparing for the next step. And it also helps us provide some philosophical underpinnings of where this is where it ties into the confirmation part, Senator.
I'm looking at it because it's really a conversation that you should have with her in your office. But go ahead.
Well, I think it's a broader, but if I was hoping to, through the committee, this is the recorded part of it. I don't record my office meetings, and that's where I wanted to have that discussion of the broad policy things. Where do we have agreement between the legislature and the administration? So I'll leave it at that and develop the discussion document.
Right, because we have a bill. We'll get into that. You'll have that opportunity. Or unless you're going to file another bill.
I'm busy enough.
Okay. Anybody else? We have other questions? Senator Giesel.
Commissioner, you talked about putting out an RFP that would assess health care reform, you know, what other states are doing, waiver programs, et cetera. So what's the time frame on that RFP? When are you expecting to actually see a result document?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, so the process is, I believe the report will be to the department, and I'm sorry, to the legislature next year, building, but these are, again, much bigger reform efforts that are, I guess for lack of a better term, kind of sea change Medicaid reform efforts of looking at reform efforts that would really totally change the way we deliver Medicaid in our state. So we think it's probably going to take a year to be able to get there. I guess less than a year because now it's March. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe that. But January of 2016. Yeah. But they would build upon the reform efforts that are already undertaking.
Somewhat. I serve on legislative budget and audit, and we have last year passed a bill that requires us to audit different departments, and we did corrections last year. So we're actually working on an RFP to audit your department next. So I think it'll be interesting to compare the documents in terms of efficiencies in the Department of Health to begin with, and what you see as far as Medicaid changes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We have any other questions? Senator Geisel, we have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In accordance with AS 3905080, the Health and Social Services Committee has reviewed the following appointment and will be forwarding it to joint session for confirmation. Valerie Davidson, Commissioner, Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay, do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and forward Ms. Davidson's to the full legislature. And again, this doesn't denote any support or non-support. We'll take that up on the floor of the Joint Committee. I'd like to congratulate you for surviving the one of many meetings that we're going to have with your department over the next couple of years while we try to work through these large issues on cost containment and pros and cons of any expansions of virtually anything. Frankly, that's going to cost the Treasury. Do we have any other comments before Senator Stoltz?
Not on this nomination, but Senator Stedman, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, one of our other nominees for the Victims of Violent Crime Composition has sat through the hearings, Dr. George Brown, and I just wanted to acknowledge he was here and sat through those, although we didn't have any contention with this issue. I appreciate his background in pediatrics and Alaskan service, and he's following the tough act of some pretty impressive members, Gerard Godfrey, Leroy Barker, and Regina Chenault, and many others. So I just wanted to acknowledge he sat through this meeting and has been quieter than I have.
Okay. Well, that was good because I didn't recognize him. I know there's a new face in the room. A lot of the folks here, we see each other time and time again over the years. Okay, we will go ahead and adjourn the meeting. We will have another gathering of the CLAN, the Health and Human Services, our CLAN on Wednesday, 1:30. We are adjourned.